No soldiers on earth are better or fiercer fighters than the Americans, who would love to have a part in those daring, romantic, and effective commando raids which are taking the German military positions apart. Lord Louis Mountbatten, head of the British commandos, is here in Washington. What he's doing and what he told American radio and newspaper men yesterday makes me believe that Americans are soon going to have a chance in these raids, and probably stage some of their own, because this young man said that commando officers will be here in this country to train our men for this old-time raiding stuff, which reminds you of John Paul Jones and Mad Anthony Wayne all over again. And he told us American officers are now serving with these commando staffs in the British Isles right now. President Roosevelt becomes the nation's number one gas and tire rationers as the noisy groups of conflicting statement makers and the OPA economists retire into their shells and quit making statements about what they're going to do to you if you get caught using gas you shouldn't have. One hopeful statement came yesterday from the facts and figures poetic McLeish, who indicated he would get together the accurate information on gas and rubber and let the folks have it in some way that they could understand. The president, with his vast and deep knowledge of the American people and their very human nature, takes control as a huge uprising of congressmen against nationwide gas rationing has gelled into a House committee of 8 members, headed by the cowboy and ranchman legislator, tall, dark Dick Kleberg of Corpus Christi, Texas, congressman and veteran. Kleberg told me last night that his committee had already met and was on the march, not mad at anybody, but determined either to block nationwide gas rationing or, if that turns out to be the correct solution of the tire shortage, to see to it that the whole idea is sold to the American people in such a way that they will accept it and push it themselves and not have to be prodded from the rear like so many lagging steers. There'll be no whipping up the dragging steers, said Kleberg. The American people, you know, are not cattle. And take it from me, folks, what Washington needs is less talk, more coordination, and constructive education. Yesterday, for instance, we had everything from threats to follow up, we follow you from home to office and back again, to see what you're doing with the gas, to the doleful prediction of Transportation Coordinator Joe Eastman, who shook his head and said it'll be years and years before there's any more rubber for tires at all. But the Senate of the United States said, oh yeah, and they appointed a committee to find out some way of really retreading tires from all that scrap rubber that Jesse Jones and others says is laying around here like just so many cast-off newspapers. And that's all from Washington at this time.
John McVain is standing by in the British capital. Go ahead, London.
This is London. I've just come from a wedding to this broadcast. The girl was an American Army nurse stationed in Northern Ireland, and the man was an English doctor, a lieutenant in the Royal Army Medical Corps. As far as I know, the girl, who comes from Boston, was the first American Army nurse to marry an Englishman here. She asked me to be a witness because I was the only American she knew in London, and she said she wanted one of her own countrymen to be present at the biggest moment in her life. The American girl knows that her husband will have to go abroad soon. She'll be with the American Army in Europe for the rest of the war. So they decided that because they were in love, it was no use waiting for the end of the war. The end may be a long way off, and neither of them knows what will happen before it comes. The ceremony was a brief one, but there were flowers and even a bottle of champagne. The bride didn't wear white. She wore the smart blue uniform of the American Army nurses with the second lieutenant's gold bars on the shoulders. The groom was in British officer's khaki. It was a war wedding, but seeing them you felt that they had a lot of faith in the future, and you couldn't help feeling proud of that pretty American girl who'd only been a few days in London. Proud that she had the courage to believe in building a future now, that the spectacle of war and certain separation from her husband didn't faze her. It all made you feel proud to be an American, too. A strong force of Ariete bombers attacked industrial objectives in the Ruhr last night. 13 bombers are missing. Fighters were in night operations over northern France, and they went over France again this morning. About 4 o'clock yesterday morning, British and Indian infantry, supported by tanks, attacked the German positions west of Knightsbridge on the Libyan front. This morning's official report says the first phase was successful, and fighting by armored forces continued all day. Air and land forces cooperated. South African troops attacked German strong points in the northern sector and brought back a number of prisoners. Bir Hakeim, which is reported to have received considerable reinforcements, was quiet yesterday after the repeated attacks for the last couple of days. As you know, the American General Grant tanks are in action in the Middle East now. The British sergeant who's fought in one of them is reported as saying, with these tanks, we're ready to take on and beat up anything the enemy can put against us in the desert. 2 days ago, 50 German Mark III and Mark IV tanks launched a flank attack against 8 Grants. The American tanks destroyed 14 of the German tanks and forced them to retreat. British commentators today are discussing China's position, and a good many of today's newspaper editorials have something to say on the subject. The Manchester Guardian, the influential provincial paper, points out that the collapse of the Burma front is both a sharp disappointment and a material loss for China. The Guardian says China's touch with their friends is precarious, and the Burma Road has become a convenient path for Japanese invasion. Although the London press today plays up the arrival of the giant British convoy in India, some commentators believe that Japan is more likely to concentrate on invading China than to try to get across the mountains into India itself. The Guardian takes the line that although all possible help should be sent to China, nevertheless, the Allies must direct their weapons to the points from which they can do the most harm to Japan with the least cost in transport and shipping. The paper says that by doing this, the Allies will be giving the best aid they can to China's struggle for freedom. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Across the Atlantic again, this time to neutral Sweden. David Anderson reports from Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. During the past few days, we have had ample proof to show that the Northern Front may increase in importance in the very near future. On Thursday, as you will remember, Hitler spent the day with Mannerheim behind the Finnish lines. As I told you at the time, this once again brought up the question of a combined German-Finnish drive on Leningrad. Since then, Sweden has been made doubly conscious of the German preparatory activity in Finland. During the past few days, the Germans have run a veritable air ferry service between Norway and Finland. This may mean that German liaison officers are being shuttled between Norway and Finland with the intention of acquiring better coordination in a potential drive on Leningrad and Murmansk. The big question here today is whether or not Finland will participate in either of these potential drives. On this point, well-informed opinions are divided. As I told some of you on Thursday, this would eliminate the last Finnish excuse in the eyes of the Allies, in this case particularly America, which says, quote, this is a private war, unquote. Then, too, the loss of between 60 to 65,000 Finnish soldiers in killed alone so far during the war doesn't give the Finnish High Command any too much incentive to run the risk of losing any more Finnish men. But there's no one here who doubts the volume or effects of German pressure at this stage, and there are some who even see the real beginnings of German-Finnish cooperation. In this connection, it is interesting to compare the speeches which were made in connection with the recent celebration of Mannerheim's birthday. If you read them, you will have seen how Mannerheim tried to avoid speaking too generously of the associated destinies of Germany and Finland. It's true that he spoke, quote, of our brothers in arms, unquote, and of the cooperation of Finland and Germany in building up a new Europe. But beyond this, he didn't venture to go. It is also felt here that if Finnish public opinion has any effects, there will be no increased German-Finnish cooperation on the Northern Front. But the answer to this still lies in the future. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
Now we take you to Mid-Pacific. Here is a report from Honolulu.
Tons of rich dirt from the Hawaiian Islands and shrubs and ironwood trees were planted. Pan American Airways started their station on Midway in 1935. 3 years later, Congress appropriated $5 million for the development of the strategic isle as an outpost for Hawaiian defense, an offensive base against Japan, and as a guard for cross-Pacific supply lines from Australia to the United States. And by the fall of 1938, with tons of equipment and a cool million or two as a starter, the United States engineers began a rush job. Japan's special envoy, Kurosu, spent some days on Midway, only 25 days before the Pearl Harbor attack, when he was en route to Washington by clipper. They didn't know the treachery in his heart then. Midway is composed of two low coral islands, which have a land area together of only about 8 square miles. These are ringed by a coral reef some 40 miles around, enclosing a large, quiet lagoon, large enough to hold many ships at anchor. The clipper planes used to land in the lagoon, and travelers spent the night in a modern hotel, but didn't always sleep because of the hooting of the goony birds. Midway under attack is a strong base for submarines, planes, and warships. It has hidden power, but mystery shrouds its placid waters. On that little sun-baked sandspit, not unlike Wake Island in appearance and strategic value, history is being made. And it isn't likely that the Japanese will do any more poaching on Midway for a long time to come. I return you to San Francisco.
That was Jim Wall speaking from Honolulu. This is San Francisco, returning you now to the newsroom in New York.
Here in the newsroom in New York, the plight of Chinese troops defending the city of Chuxian in Chekiang province is growing tense. The Japanese are battering at the gates of Chuxian with at least 90,000 men. 10,000 of the invaders already have fallen out of the original striking force. But still the Japanese push on. Tokyo claims this morning that the city's airfield has been captured. And the United States Air Force, striking from India at the invaders of Burma, has lost one of its bombers the first time in 2 months of attacking. The bomber was shot down during an assault on Rangoon as the American raiders blasted the docks and shipping in that conquered Burmese supply port. On the Russian front, Moscow announces that Red Army troops operating on the central front behind German lines have accounted for 100 Nazis and 8 tanks. In an attack on the Kalinin front settlement, Soviet scouts have wiped out a 100-man garrison, and Soviet guerrillas have derailed a German troop train, killing 250 soldiers. In Libya, British and Axis forces are jockeying for position. Frontline dispatchers say that strategist Rommel has lost 340 tanks. These have been the reports by John McVane from London, Earl Godwin from Washington, David Anderson from Stockholm, and the NBC Newsroom in Honolulu. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.